everyone, and welcome to Big Chat, a podcast series by Norfolk's cancer charity, Big C, where we talk all things cancer-related, from bereavement and mental health to prevention and research. Today I am joined by Mike Marshall, former vicar and now a cancer patient. Mike has pancreatic, colon and rectal cancer, and joining him is Julian Pollard, one of our support and information nurses.
Hi, my name is Mike Marshall, and I'm 69 and lived in Norwich for 4 years, 5 years actually, and I'm married to Rose, who I'll mention no doubt during the course of this chat. The diagnosis was initially peripancreatic cancer in 2017, and then that progressed to colon cancer and rectal cancer as well. So I've had three operations. The most recent one was in March of this year, and that's the one I'm recovering from at the moment.
Yeah, hi, my name's Jules. I'm one of the support and information nurses that works for Big C, and I've had the pleasure of knowing Michael for a little while now and supporting him through some of the things that he's been going through over the last year or so.
And Michael, when were you first diagnosed and what prompted you to get your diagnosis in the first place?
I was conscious as I walked the dog that that I wasn't feeling well, and I was becoming jaundiced, and I didn't go immediately to the doctors. And ironically, I'd been invited to speak at a weekend. I was a vicar and I'd been invited to speak at a weekend because the previous speaker had been dropped out through illness. And I thought, well, I can't do anything about what I'm feeling at the moment because I've taken over this role from somebody else. But immediately I got back from that that weekend away, I took up a hospital appointment and began to realise that I wasn't just poorly, but something quite serious was wrong.
And what was the symptoms of that exactly?
The itchiness, because of the cancer was on the bile duct, and so it was difficult to excrete the breakdown blood products, and so they were in the bloodstream and they were causing itchiness and typical yellow jaundice. There was a great discomfort, and subsequent tests showed a small cancer on the bile round puller.
After you sort of became aware that there was something kind of quite seriously wrong, Mike, were you quite quick to get in touch with the GP, and did that sort of move quite quickly after you did?
I found the GP great. He said he was quite clear that, and this happened before we were going away for the weekend, I just didn't want him to say you can't go away. He was very good and said, I'm starting you on the initial cancer diagnostic procedure. So that's what we're looking at and looking for. So I knew that when I went to the hospital, I knew what they were looking for. But of course, well, not of course, too many of courses. I'll clarify that as we go along the story.
And what were your initial thoughts upon your diagnosis?
I'm quite a positive person. So I thought when they talked about a growth on this small biliary tract, I thought, well, that's fine. I'll just chop that out. That'll be pretty easy. It was when I was having an endoscopy from which they then admitted me into hospital that I realised they were taking it very seriously. And I was reading one of the notices on the wall, diagnostic features of pancreatic cancer, that I read mine out perfectly. And I remember noting in my diary, I think I wrote whoops, WHOOPS, exclamation mark, because I realised that this might be serious, more serious than I was thinking.
So you mentioned three different cancers. Is that because it's spread, or are they separate?
We've never been clear on that. The first one was a small growth of a particular kind blocking the bile duct, and once that was dealt with, the shock was that they, in order to tackle that, they gave me a very large operation, the Whipple's procedure, taking out huge bits of my insides. And when I asked why they were doing that, they said, because this is the operation that works. And that's when I realised how serious it was. We don't know whether the second cancer I had or the third cancer I had were mastitizations of that first one. They quite frankly just don't know.
And what were your friends and family's initial thoughts once they heard you not only had one form of cancer, but another two?
Well, of course, these were sequential over 4 years, about 18 months in between, with bouts of chemotherapy and radiotherapy, both before and after some of the operational procedures. And so the family were right with me in it. They were great, actually. And no doubt we'll say more about that. I kept them in touch with exactly what was going on. And from the moment I was in hospital, they were very much alongside my children in their 20s and 30s with their own families. And two of my daughters live in the town we're in Norwich, and were very much part of what was going on.
I think that's something we've discussed in the past, isn't it, Michael? The importance of accurate information to family and friends to alleviate the worry and alleviate the kind of grasping for information and reducing anxiety in the process.
I think absolutely, Jules. I think one of my big anxieties were fears and trauma they'd be going through about my illness, and. Because we were sharing so openly and speaking so freely about it, they were fully acquainted with all that was going on. And I was astonished, actually, that I shouldn't have been treating them like children, because they were grown-ups and were a great support to me. And so any reticence on my part in talking to them initially was very much misplaced, similarly with my wife.
And have any of your family used the support services at Big C as well as yourself?
Yes, I thought I was fine following the second operation when we were in Norwich. That was in Norwich Hospital. I thought I was fine, but I saw that Rose, my wife, was quite stressed by simply the disruption, the anxiety about where this was leading since there'd been a second cancer, I was just going for a regular checkup at the hospital, and I called in at the Big C and just to chat to them, and I thought, I'm sure there'd be somebody here who could talk to Rose, my wife. I chatted to a lovely lady there, and she said, well, we happen to have somebody who is available this afternoon, why don't you might help Rose if she comes down and chats. And so I went back and made that suggestion to her, and she said yes, she would. And she found that so helpful that she came immediately back to me and said, Mike, I think you ought to talk to somebody as well at the Big C. And I thought, well, I hadn't gone in there for that purpose. I'd gone in to see if there's somebody who you might be able to chat to. But I thought very arrogantly that, well, if she was doing it, it might help if I did it as well. So I did and met Jules. And so I've continued that relationship, as has Rose, with the person she's been chatting to, then through the third cancer, that's continued.
Have there been any particular worries or stresses since being diagnosed that Big C have helped with, whether that's financial, emotional, or any sort of medical?
I've, as Jules has intimated, I once we start talking, I can talk quite long. And Jules has been very good at fielding things from a whole range of subjects. Nothing's been off limits, and I've talked to him about if there's been certain medical things that I said, well, what do you think about that? And he's given a medical opinion upon it as far as his experience has allowed. I've said, what if we get to the point where I can't have any more procedures? Can we talk about end of life care, and can you talk me through the different pathways that are there? Because actually, you might think I know, but I don't. And Jules has been very good at talking about that as well. And he's steered us in the direction also of financial help and aid that we can have through attendance allowance. And we've just gone through that process, and that has been very, very helpful with people that he's put us on to. And so over a whole range of areas, there's been the sense that there's nothing we couldn't explore if it was concerning me. One, I think, very important thing that the big C for me has been, and Jules, is that it's been possible to look into, through our conversations, as if I'm looking at a mirror, and whereas I, like everybody, think I'm stable and exactly the same person all the time, talking to someone else enables them to say, actually, I can tell you're a bit down at the moment, or I can tell you're worried about this, or what is this bothering you? And I'd have said, well, yes, it is, but I hadn't thought so. And so that has been a mirror to myself, has been a very useful part of the conversational procedures we've had.
And how long is it you've actually been supported by Big C then?
Well, I haven't looked at my diary, and I hate to say, but it was certainly after the previous operation, which was in 2019. So it must be, I'd guess it's 2 years now.
Yeah, I would say, yeah.
Is that about right?
That would be about right, yeah.
Yeah.
And how did you feel from going from years being supported within like the Big C Centre at Norwich to then over the last year and a half now, having to be supported online? How have you felt being able to cope with that? Has that been all right?
That's been very good. That has worked well, very good. And I've shied away from being linked up with anything larger than that. But maybe that's for the future. But of course, that's not so possible on Zoom.
Yeah, and I think we've certainly brushed over that in the past, haven't we? And
yeah, we have.
And it's a very individual choice how people are supported and how people receive that support. Some people flourish within a group and enjoy that comfort of a group of peers. Other people, not so much. And that's ultimately a very individual choice, and there is no right or wrong way to receive support. It's whatever people feel comfortable with. And I think the most important thing is that actually people do seek that support. And I think you'd probably agree with that just now, Michael.
I totally agree with it, and certainly endorse the effectiveness of groups, since I've led so many groups in the past in my line of work anyway. Maybe that's just more comfortable leading them than being a part of one, which is not very noble.
So did you ever try to attend any of the groups pre-COVID then?
No, I didn't actually, no. And I think what I found easiest in talking to Jules was that he never put anything on me particularly, or said, I think you ought to do this, or how about this? He was very receptive to what seemed to be what I needed and wanted, and helped me discover what I needed and wanted without being pushy and pigeonholing me and saying, I think this would be really good for you, and putting me in a particular direction.
And I think that's, you know, that's just kind of, that reiterates the kind of tact that we take at Big C and treat everyone as an individual and bend to their needs, as opposed to them bending to ours.
I think that's right, Jules. And I think it might be worth people who are at all wary realizing that I think there's a phrase you used. Was it talking therapy? I mean, we aren't counselling. We're just opening up a forum where we can discuss and talk. And I think therefore the legitimacy of comfort is very important there, with no strong directive mandate.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point to make, actually, Mike, that, you know, the difference between a formal talking therapy, be that CBT or person-centred or a more directive type of approach, is something very different to what the nursing and support staff offer. Of course, Big C offer that more formal channel of yes, talking therapy, but the conversation and the supportive nature of the relationship that we formed is a different animal.
Yeah.
And just on the subject of opening up, as this is going out during Men's Health Week, and I don't know if you want to weigh in on this at all, Jules, but I just wonder then if that's also whether either of you feel that men might particularly find it more comfortable opening up one-on-one, whether in a group setting.
Yeah, I think men initially find it more useful to open up on an individual basis before perhaps trying some form of peer support. But I think the majority of men, as Mike alluded to at the beginning, actually will engage in a support service more because they're looking for support for their family and loved ones, and then may see the power of that, and that's potentially the way in.
I think that's right, and I also think there is a cliche of the retardedness of men to talk to others and engage in deeper conversation. It is a cliche, but it's a self-reinforcing cliche. It's become one where men perhaps think that's not the done thing. I think the current climate of sports people focusing, men particularly focusing on mental health, will blow that cliche out of the water. I think people will be ready to talk more and at least in principle, but taking the first steps of doing so might need degrees of skill in yourselves and colleagues in drawing people out.
Yeah, it's kind of like they always say like it's a cliche for a reason, isn't it?
Because yes, exactly.
I just wondered what you would say to try and help men maybe open up a bit more, and why you think it is that they feel this more pressure that they can't compared to women.
Why be frightened? Why live with the fears that are there? Why not talk about them? And again, I'm suddenly realizing I'm descending into cliche again. But the reality is, talking does help enormously. People know that deep down, but it's taking the steps of doing it.
I think that the power of talking is just so underestimated. And the amount of times I hear someone say, do you know what, there's been a weight lifted off me. And nothing more has happened than them just verbalizing their hopes, fears, dreams, aspirations. And that's it. Nothing else has happened apart from the verbalization. And just purely by verbalizing it, it lifts a weight from people and opens a new avenue of exploring all kinds of support. Yeah, so no, it's I reiterate what Mike said, it's just do it.
And obviously it's not just for the men who we do support who have cancer themselves, it's also the men who have a partner who is affected by cancer as well, who probably feel like they need to be a bit stronger in that sense for them, and they can't they might not feel like they can share their emotions so much.
And that is in some ways, of course, to be acknowledged and commended, but strength comes from unity with others. And I think expanding your concerns with others is just such a great, great help. I do think, again, it's another truism. And as you say, truisms are there because they're so often true, but it doesn't mean we can't work around them. There is that sense that you've got to be strong. You've got to be strong for others. I've certainly felt that and been profoundly humbled in realising how strong my wife and family are, and that it's not all down to me. And that is great liberation, tremendous liberation.
And do you feel like your line of work, Mike, has kind of helped you in that sense as well? Because you've obviously spent a lot of your time talking to people, so you've kind of had a bit more experience, I guess, of people opening up.
I would like to think yes, because I'd like to be able to say yes after all these years. But it's never been something that I've had to put into practice. So I'm very good at drawing others out and helping them and hearing people say, I've never said anything like this to anybody else before, but I've never been the person that's done that. So I've had my world turned upside down and had to learn some things pretty quickly, which I'm very grateful for having had to learn them.
So your role was kind of switched in that sense.
Absolutely.
Then I guess, how do you feel like your life changed once you was diagnosed?
I'd retired in 2015, and the first cancer happened 2017, about 15 months later. And so life hasn't worked out as we thought it would. So there's been resentment, a degree of frustration and anger. I've always been a very, very keen sportsman and was very active in sport through my 60s, and I just can't do that. And so I'm cross about it, and I can't be the person, you know, I can't, when somebody rings me up and says, can you come and do this, do that, I can't do it. I think actually accommodating the new reality to the situation I'm in has taken time, but you do get there. And dealing with the various practical consequences of the operations I've had is a life changer, and I've had to learn to do that. So life has changed its direction markedly, but you learn to cope with that. I certainly have had more empathetic conversations with friends who are going through tough times. And I've also had friends, I think, who really squirm away from the details of what's been happening to me. And I've had not had so much contact with them. I think my physical capacity for a lot of fairly intimate relationships has dropped away a bit. It's just hard work keeping up with everybody. And I suspect that one or two think that the next notice they're going to get is that I'm not around anymore. So I keep popping up and surprising them. But people certainly do respond to me differently to the person I was before I was this cancer survivor, stroke sufferer.
How would you say that the process of going through cancer treatment has been during COVID, not just the treatment either itself, but also just whether you had to shield during that period?
I had to shield. I think we've been very fortunate. We've got a nice home, and there's my wife and myself here, and we are quite resourceful. So I've been able to do write and read a lot, which I've enjoyed. The timing of the lockdowns seems appalling, but in actual fact it hasn't interfered with my treatment. I've been able to go into hospital and have the procedures that I've needed. I think it did delay the third diagnosis a bit, because certain scans were cancelled and the operation was far more radical than we were expecting, leaving me more disabled than we expected. But on the whole, I think the NHS has been very good in as far as I'm concerned.
And how did you find the being an inpatient after that operation without having the comfort of physical visitations?
Well, that's an interesting one, because I've been able to FaceTime anybody I wanted to and have face-to-face conversations on my iPad. I had my first cancer, the pancreatic one. I was in hospital in Cambridge, and I couldn't get that many visits from people. My family rallied and tried to get me a visitor every day from somewhere. I suddenly thought, actually, I don't want a visitor every day from somewhere. I want to talk to the people I'd like to talk to.
Do you feel it affected your family in that sense? Like you just mentioned, they were trying to get you a visitor. Do you feel like it affected them not being able to see you for those periods?
I don't think so. I think they're very much in communication with each other. So the news net was very active, and whoever came to see me would always report. And I'd be in telephone touch or FaceTime touch with everybody whenever we wanted. And I think that worked quite well. But I might be odd, so I'm perfectly ready to accept that.
No, I think it sort of makes a really good point, actually, that you know, family, friends, they're desperate to do everything they can to make the situation better, and yeah, sometimes may make the wrong decision. And that's where an honest, open dialogue about everything that's going on and how everyone's feeling is just so important.
There are a number of people, of course, and cancer is so emotive. There are many, many people who know exactly what you need to do to never get cancer again. And mm-hmm. A number of people, of friends who've of the family, who've sent in their remedies, whether it's curly kale or whatever it is, that this was, you know, if only you did this, you wouldn't be ill anymore. And so that is tiresome. And Rose, my wife, has been very, very good at shielding me from people who know exactly what to do if I want to be completely well again. I think we've been sensible. We've shielded when particularly necessary, and obeyed all the rules and regulations, but we've got out and seen people whenever we can. And that face-to-face contact has been very, very good. I've been quite surprised at the fear and anxiety of some people who aren't ill, who've so isolated themselves, I think, to the detriment of their own mental health. I think getting out has been important for us, and dialogue with people has been very important. I think what surprised me was how, having said all of that, what surprised me was how safe home came to be. And Rose really needs, as do I, a holiday, but we haven't been able to take one. And I thought, well, I'm not bothered, because I know where everything is in the house, and I know we're near the hospital. I know if I don't feel well, I can get help immediately. I've suddenly found myself not necessarily being institutionalized in hospital, but in home, drawing in my parameters. And I didn't think that was healthy. And indeed, as we started to go out more over the past few weeks, I was really surprised about how emotional I found it going into John Lewis in Norwich a couple of weeks ago. It was almost euphoric. I felt freed, and that was an indicator of how enclosed I had been without realizing it.
Just talking on that a bit more, some of our centres are going to start to reopen in July time. How do you feel about them opening again?
Personally, I'd be very happy, yes. I think, there again, it's quite easier for me because we're 5 minutes up the road. I, in all of my hospital treatment, I was thinking how hard it's been for those coming in from the wilder ends of the county. But yes, I think A, I'd be more interested in doing that, and B, I think I'd want to help people do that as well.
I just wanted to ask, what area of the support process have you found to be the most valuable to you and your family as well, the members who have used our services?
I think that the practical help, the preparedness to of Jules to either be a conduit to other information or to be ready to chat about anything, and I've welcomed that enormously. I cannot believe that if people aren't talking about it, they're still not reflecting on their own mortality, what the future holds, and how am I going to negotiate that? What do I really believe, and who can I talk to about that without anybody preaching at me, and things like that. And I think that I've been pleasantly surprised, Jules, if he doesn't mind me saying so, at recognising that nothing is off limits. And so if I wanted to talk about how I found my faith so very, very important in this difficult time, he hasn't in any way said, oh, well, let's not talk about that. That's an area that we're talking about, your cancer and your mental health, etc. The conversational opportunities have been wide open for where I've been coming from, and I found that very useful.
Yeah. And what advice do you think you'd give to others going through the same thing as you?
I'd ask them a question. So how do you think you are going to negotiate this next period of life, or indeed death for you? How do you want it to go? Do you want to be lonely? This is brutal, but I'd say, is it going to be a lonely journey? A journey is another cliche. Or is it going to be something where you've got friends to be with you and alongside you? I would say you need to be making decisions on that rather than just living in a jittery, unknown fear about what comes next or how do you handle what comes next. Where are your resources and where will you go if you wake up in the middle of the night and think, I've got no idea what I'm going to do about that? And I'd urge them to have some strategies in place.
Jules, I just wanted to ask, actually, based on the questions that Mike just asked there, saying about being isolated and stuff, do you think that can be quite a common thing within your experience of working with cancer patients, that they do, that they can tend to isolate themselves a bit more?
Yeah, very much so. And the opportunity always exists, but potentially, you know, post-surgery and you're convalescing in your home, all of a sudden this becomes a very safe place. And as Mike said, you know, institutionalization in your own home can set in very quickly. And then that limits social interactions and that limits life opportunities. And it's very important to be aware of that and not to let that happen. But over this last year of COVID, it's happened to pretty much all of us to a certain degree, unless you're an essential worker and you've been allowed out of your house, you know. And I can absolutely, you know, think about euphoric moment of leaving the house and going to the beach for the first time in 6 months. You know, you forget what that's like and you forget how important it is for in-person contact. And, you know, I myself as a healthcare professional cannot wait to be with the people I support face to face. And I think we've reflected on it before, Mike, that, you know, we've had video calls, we've had telephone calls, and we've had obviously face to face sessions, and the power between and the differences between the three communication channels are absolutely vast. So I think we spoke over the phone after you were discharged from your last operation, and it was a very difficult conversation because I didn't have those, you know, visual clues, and I'm used to speaking with Mike over video. So it was, you know, it makes it a very, very difficult thing to just speak over the phone, and, you know, in-person interactions are so powerful, and I myself can't wait to get back to it.
I think it is a new tool that's been learned, which can be used and deployed, but will never replace that essential clue-ridden conversational face-to-face time that is necessary for real human interaction.
And I think the power of touch as well can't be underestimated. No. The shake of a hand or the touch on a shoulder, you know, the close proximity, the eye contact, which, you know, you can maintain eye contact over Zoom, but it's nowhere near as effective as in-person eye contact and body language. And yeah, so
you mentioned body language. I mean, just the shift of position of somebody in a chair when they're either asked or asking a question is so eloquent, and that cannot be replaced over a video screen.
I think as well, when we come to open the centres, we're going to have it so there will be some sessions where people can come in person if they want to, but then we're also going to have online sessions as well still, aren't we, Jules? So people can feel, so if they can't make it into the centres.
Yeah, I think so, because, the you know, as we were just talking about, the sort of the institutionalisation within your own home, the hangover from COVID could potentially take years to undo. And people, you know, we live in a large rural county with people that are socially isolated due to geography, but are now socially isolated due to an ingrained institutionalization of being at home. And I think we need to keep the conduits of the support network that we have put in place virtually open for these people so they don't become disenfranchised in the coming months and years.
If we recognise that truism, the cliche of a difficulty in opening up, in talking and chatting, then a gradation of approach for anybody who has the reticence to a sharp degree is very important. Maybe a telephone call first, then a video call, then leading to face-to-face contact, etc. It's that ability to move into something by degrees of comfort rather than immediately.
Yeah. Very much so, yeah. And that's how things have kind of progressed over this COVID period. Things often start with a telephone call, quite anonymous form of communication. And as that relationship builds over the telephone, potentially a video call can be introduced. Potentially then a video support group can be introduced, and it opens up a whole world. And hopefully in the future that will open up a physical support session within one of the centres, be that a support group or, you know, more formal counselling, or some of the sessions that, you know, Big C support, like Look Good, Feel Better, or some of the lovely complementary therapies that we offer. You know, it opens up a whole world of physical interventions as well.
Regarding the Big C, I do remember first time in hospital following the early diagnosis of the peripancreatic cancer, the blockage. It was a brilliant hot summer June day, so it must have been 4 years ago. And I was walking around the hospital with my family, and my son-in-law said, "What's that place there?" And I said, "It's the Big C Centre." And he said, "Is it because it's shaped like a C?" And I laughed and said, "No, it's because it's a cancer centre." And I remember at the time thinking, that's got nothing to do with me. I can't see that I'd ever go there or what's it for, etc. I was totally ignorant and didn't ask those questions. And I think that for those who have become familiar with what is on offer and what can be delivered and what can be helped with, have barriers to overcome, including the admission that I'm a cancer patient and this is what I've got, and therefore I ought to be addressing and looking at those places that are saying we can help. So there's a boundary of admission to cross before you can make that contact, I think.
What do you say exactly to people who are like yourself in that sense, that they feel like that centre's not for them, that like they don't need that, after your experience of using our services and realising how beneficial they are?
I think only by going alongside and saying, "Hey, do you know what? I found the needs I thought I didn't have been addressed by the place that I didn't know." And I think I say, try and say something like that. And I'd refer back to my previous comment about how do you see the next years unfolding, and where are you going to get your support from? Because there are going to be things you need to talk about.
I think so. In the physical sense, it's often a huge step for people to walk into a cancer support centre, because it's almost that admission.
It is the admission.
Admission that when you walk through the door, I think, you know, you can speak to numerous people that have walked through that door for the first time. There is no pressure. There is no obligation to talk to anyone. It's just a safe haven, and you will find the support that you need when you need it.
Nice cup of coffee as well.
Nice cup of coffee and a nice piece of cake.
And do remember, Jules, that I walked into the Big C Centre as a cancer sufferer to look for help from my wife. Mm-hmm. That's why I came in. So that shows how often reluctant the sufferer, survivor, patient is to admit the need of their own personal condition.
I think Mike's just been incredible. So, you know, I mean, that's just a really articulate kind of representation of the journey that you've been on, Mike, and, you know, and your interaction with, you know, our small service here in Norfolk. And, you know, I can't thank you enough for your time. And
I'm just very pleased to have done so. I'm very pleased to continue being involved, and certainly very pleased to continue coming to you for help.
Looking forward to seeing you in the physical sense very, very
Absolutely.
Soon.
Yeah, and looking forward to that. Great. And lovely to meet you, Becky.
Yeah, it was lovely to meet you. Thank you so much for doing that.
God bless.
All right. Bye-bye. All the best. Take care for now.
Thank you. Thank you so much for speaking to me today, and thank you so much to our audience for listening in again. Remember to follow us on social media. Our handles are Big C Charity on Facebook and Instagram, and on Twitter it's Big C Tweets. Thanks again for listening. Bye.